For more, we're joined by Peter Goodman, no relation, New York Times global economics correspondent. His recent piece is headlined, Beneath the Potential Strike at U.S. Ports, Tensions Over Innovation. His new book is titled, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. Peter, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Explain what just took place at midnight. We're talking about Maine to Texas.
Right.
The ports are shut down.
Yeah, we're talking about 36 shipping terminals at 14 different port authorities. We're talking about ports that are the gateway for roughly half of all the imported goods reaching the United States. Contract ended at midnight, and the dock workers walked off their jobs. They're seeking higher wages and guarantees that they will not be replaced through automation.
And Peter, in terms of the workers have been talking about the huge profits that the shipping companies have been making. Could you talk about that in context of their wage demands?
Yeah. So for a good period after the pandemic, where we had these massive disruptions that were enormous profit opportunities for the shipping companies. You know, we read a lot of headlines that it's chaos when we have these giant queues off of the twin ports of L.A. and Long Beach, the West Coast ports that are the gateway for about 40% of all imported goods reaching the country by container ship. And there's this implication that this is somehow bad for the ocean carriers. But the unfunny punchline of every one of these episodes, whether it's floating traffic jams or more recently restrictions on traffic moving through the Panama Canal because of drought, or ships that can't go through the Suez Canal because of strikes by Houthi rebels who are acting in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Every single time there's disruption, we see prices go up and profits go to record levels for the ocean carriers. At the same time, the dock workers, who have very dangerous jobs, they're very physically rigorous jobs. They are highly paid, but their position is we're entitled to that as compensation. Their wages have actually flatlined. They've stagnated compared to inflation. And so they're seeking what looks like a very substantial headline increase, you know, 70%+. It's been reported, though there's a lot of there's not a lot of open discussion of these terms over the next several years. And overnight, it seems like the port operators tried to bridge the distance with a package that they say would be about a 50% raise. The dock workers say that's not enough. And one of the things they're very concerned about is the push. This is a historic push. It goes back to the beginning of container shipping in the 1950s to replace them with robots, other forms of automation. Robots don't go on strike. They don't have sick kids to take care of at home. They don't need time off with their families. This really goes back to the beginning of the container industry, where time and again, employers have sought to use various forms of technology to limit their vulnerability to exactly what we've got now, a work stoppage as dock workers seek a greater piece of the action.
And could you talk about how the emphasis for the several decades now of worldwide capital of having just-in-time production lines of products coming in to be sold immediately, how well the American industry can withstand a long strike?
Well, a long strike is going to be tough because we've already seen a lot of diversion of cargo from East Coast ports to West Coast ports. Congestion could quickly build up if that continues. We've seen a little bit of diversion to places like Mexican ports, where we've got road and rail connections into the U.S. And eventually on to Canada. But those ports are much smaller. They're less efficient. The rail system, by the way, has really been depleted by a version of just-in-time known as precision scheduled railroading, which is essentially a fancy way of saying, let's fire lots of workers. Let's stick the remaining workers with extra jobs. They've diminished service. They've made trains longer than ever. So accidents tend to be much more dangerous. And it's really about boosting returns for shareholders at the expense of the operational capacity of the rail system. So the idea that rail will pick up the burden is really dubious. If this thing goes on, we're likely to see serious congestion off the West Coast ports, similar to what we saw during the pandemic. You know, container ships turned into floating warehouses, and we are likely to see product shortages and potentially inflation if this goes on for a few weeks.
The president of the International Longshoremen's Association, Harold Daggett, endorsed Biden in the 2020 election, but more recently accused Biden of, quote, not fighting for us. Last November, Daggett said he had a productive meeting with former President Trump at Mar-a-Lago. He spoke in a video released by the union last month.
We went on strike in 1977 for 3 months for 80 cents. Fast forward. Back then, the companies were lucky to make. They made millions of dollars, to $10 million, $5 million. Today, they make billions and billions of dollars. They make, MSC is the richest shipping company in the world, made three times the money than Amazon. A lot of money, right? Billions. Well, one of the companies, and I won't mention his name, he took himself the Christmas bonus, $4 billion. He took it out for him and his family. $4 billion. A French company, I won't mention their name, they gave all their employees 50 months' salary as a Christmas gift. Now, look at that money. They have so much money, they don't even know what to do with it.
A $4 billion bonus for the boss. That's president of the International Longshoremen's Association, Harold Daggett. Peter Goodman, can you talk about what he said sure. and also the significance of U.S. business groups wanting Biden to invoke the Taft-Hartley Act and Biden saying he's not going to and what that means?
Sure. It's a very strange dynamic because, of course, traditionally, labor, key Democratic constituency, Biden is very reluctant to wade in and end this strike because he faced a backlash when he used a different law to shut down the railroad strike 2 years ago without getting paid sick leave for traveling maintenance crews and other rail workers. So he's very reluctant to be the guy who steps in, takes away the leverage for the union. I mean, this is a time of labor mobilization in this country. And of course, we saw that the UAW did very well with a militant strike. The ILA is doing likewise. Here's the irony, though. So you've got all these business groups that are lobbying the Biden administration to act because, of course, the economy writ large is going to get hit by a long strike. Factories that are dependent upon imported components and parts are going to get hit. Retailers waiting for products to come in, often from Asia, will get hit. Consumers could face shortages, inflation. Here's the one group that probably won't get hit. The shipping carriers. I mean, I spoke last night to the chair of the Federal Maritime Commission, who said that this is the classic playbook that goes back to the pandemic, where the shipping carriers cut capacity, and what happens? Prices go up. We're talking about a cartel. This is an international cartel that's made up of three alliances. Think like airline alliances, like your Star Alliance, your One World. They've got 85 to 90% of the traffic on the key routes from Asia to Europe and from Asia to the west and east coast of the United States. So the longer this goes on, the higher the prices go, potentially the higher the profits for the shipping carriers. So the one move for the union is, well, we're going to monkey wrench the economy as a way to generate pressure for a settlement. But that could actually be good for the people they're trying to get greater leverage for. That could increase the pressure on the Biden administration, really reluctant, again, to intervene in a labor dispute to put an end to this thing, because it will hit the real economy. And I don't have to tell you that we're only weeks away from a presidential election that could very well hinge on economic sentiments and unhappiness over inflation.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us, and we have to have you back on to talk about your new book. Peter Goodman, New York Times global economics correspondent. His most recent piece, Beneath the Potential Strike at U.S. Ports, Tensions Over Innovation. We'll link to that. His new book, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. Coming up, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has broken his silence addressing the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, France. We'll play some of his comments. And then it's the last day of the presidency of Mexican President AMLO. Andrés Manuel López Obrador will talk about his legacy and also immigration. Stay with us.
There's a new dawn. Stop.
The Bottom Line by Big Audio Dynamite. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange spoke publicly today for the first time since he was released from the maximum security Belmarsh prison in London in June. He addressed the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe and France about his 14-year legal saga after publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Assange was freed from the prison in London after pleading guilty to a U.S. charge of obtaining and disclosing national security material. Assange's legal odyssey included house arrest for a year, 7 years, taking refuge in the cramped Ecuadorian embassy in London under political asylum, and then the Belmarsh prison. At the time he pled guilty, Assange was fighting extradition to the United States, where he faced up to 175 years in prison. Today marked the first time the world has heard Julian Assange's voice since British police raided the Ecuadorian embassy in 2019 and took him out. This is Julian Assange.
The transition from years of confinement in a maximum security prison to being here before the representatives of 46 nations and 700 million people is a profound and a surreal shift. The experience of isolation for years in a small cell is difficult to convey. It strips away one's sense of self, leaving only the raw essence of existence. I am yet not fully equipped to speak about what I have endured, the relentless struggle to stay alive, both physically and mentally, nor can I speak yet about the death by hanging, murder, and medical neglect of my fellow prisoners. I apologize in advance if my words falter or if my presentation lacks the polish you might expect from such a distinguished forum. Isolation has taken its toll, which I am trying to unwind, and expressing myself in this setting is a challenge. However, the gravity of this occasion and the weight of the issues at hand compel me to set aside my reservations and speak to you directly. I have travelled a long way, literally and figuratively, to be before you today. Before our discussion or answering any questions you might have, I wish to thank PACE for its 2020 resolution, which stated that my imprisonment set a dangerous precedent for journalists and noted that the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture called for my release. I'm also grateful for PACE's 2021 statement expressing concern over credible reports that US officials discussed my assassination, again calling for my prompt release. And I commend the Legal Affairs and Human Rights Committee for commissioning a renowned rapporteur, Suna Iver's daughter, to investigate the circumstances surrounding my detention and conviction and the consequent implications for human rights. However, like so many of the efforts made in my case, whether they were from parliamentarians, presidents, prime ministers, the Pope, UN officials and diplomats, unions, legal and medical professionals, academics, activists, or citizens, none of them should have been necessary. None of the statements, resolutions, reports, films, articles, events, fundraisers, protests, and letters over the last 14 years should have been necessary. But all of them were necessary, because without them, I never would have seen the light of day. This unprecedented global effort was needed because the legal protections that did exist, many existed only on paper, were not effective in any remotely reasonable time. I eventually chose freedom over unrealizable justice after being detained for years and facing a 175-year sentence with no effective remedy. Justice, for me, is now precluded as the US government insisted in writing into its plea agreement that I cannot file a case at the European Court of Human Rights or even a Freedom of Information Act request over what it did to me as a result of its extradition request. I want to be totally clear. I am not free today because the system worked. I am free today after years of incarceration because I pled guilty to journalism. I pled guilty to seeking information from a source. I pled guilty to obtaining information from a source. And I pled guilty to informing the public what that information was. I did not plead guilty to anything else. I hope my testimony today can serve to highlight the weaknesses of the existing safeguards and to help those whose cases are less visible but who are equally vulnerable. As I emerge from the dungeon of Belmarsh, the truth now seems less discernible, and I regret how much ground has been lost during that time period, how expressing the truth has been undermined, attacked, weakened, and diminished. I see more impunity, more secrecy, more retaliation for telling the truth, and more self-censorship. It is hard not to draw a line from the US government's prosecution of me, its crossing the Rubicon by internationally criminalizing journalism, to the chilled climate for freedom of expression that exists now.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange speaking publicly for the first time since he was released from the Belmarsh prison in London in June. Assange addressed the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, France, about his 14-year legal saga after publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was sitting next to his wife, the attorney Stella Assange. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Mexico's making history today as it inaugurates its first woman president. Claudia Sheinbaum, climate scientist, Mexico City's former mayor, won a landslide victory in Mexico's June elections. Sheinbaum is a member of the ruling Morena Party, close ally of outgoing Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, whose six-year term ended last night at midnight. AMLO, as he's widely known, leaves behind a complicated legacy as Mexico's most popular president in decades. He's been championed as an ally of Mexico's poorest communities with policies that increase the minimum wage, strengthen labor and union rights. AMLO's critics say he's eroded democratic oversight in Mexico, where his recent enactment of a contested judicial reform was met with protests. AMLO says the reform would crack down on corruption in courts, but critics argue the plan could threaten judicial independence. AMLO's also been accused of failing to significantly address violence in Mexico, including the murder of journalists and rising femicides. Meanwhile, indigenous leaders denounced AMLO's completion of the ambitious Tren Maya project, a 1,000-mile railway that cuts through the Yucatan Peninsula, causing deforestation and environmental destruction. For more, we're joined here in New York by Edwin Ackerman, sociology professor at Syracuse University. His recent piece for Jacobin is headlined, AMLO's War on Neoliberal Corruption. So today is the first day of Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum's presidency. Last night, the last moment of AMLO's presidency. Can you talk about the significance of both, Professor Ackerman?
Yeah, this is a historic moment on many accounts, as you were mentioning, first woman president in the country, but also coming in with a very clear mandate, having won, as you mentioned, over the election overwhelmingly, her party having secured a two-thirds majority in Congress and basically close to doing so, one short of doing so in the Senate, which is an increasing, I think, anomaly in Western democracies, at least, that are at this point sort of accustomed to political stalemate. What we have here is a very strong president at the beginning of her term who campaigned on continuity with the previous administration.
And Edwin Ackerman, could you talk about the AMLO's legacy? Here's a man who tripled the minimum wage, doubled old age pensions, lifted millions out of poverty. But yet there is a lot of criticism of him, especially in the Western media.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think we could characterize the legacy in three respects. Right? I'll try and be brief here. But one is, as you were mentioning, some of these elements, the return, I would say, of class politics, which takes the form of a series of important legislative measures that includes raising the minimum wage, facilitating the formation of unions, but also more specific things like, for example, recognizing the labor rights of domestic workers for the first time in the country. And this has produced very clear results that are increasingly incontrovertible. We have a 30% increase in the real wages of the average worker. The labor's share of income over the past 6 years has moved in favor of labor for the first time in decades. And the spending capacity of the bottom 10% of the population has increased by almost 100%. And this has meant, depending on the calculations, about 9 million people lifted out of poverty. This has meant at the same time that there's an increasing, really clear voter realignment going on, in which increasingly the working classes, particularly the peasantry, the employees and the informal sector, are the basis of support of the party, and increasingly the business sector and certain sectors of the professional middle classes are sort of moving away from its support. The second important element, I think, of his legacy is a return of the state, which takes also several forms. One, perhaps the most well-known one, is the series of major infrastructure projects that ranges from the train that was being mentioned earlier here to refineries, airports, transportation corridors, etc., producing a lot of regional development, a lot of work, public works, and so forth. There's also an effort to re-centralize a series of previously outsourced government functions. And there's also, as you were mentioning, this slate of social programs that, in short, are different ways of different sort of universal cash transfer programs, that is, not means-tested cash transfer programs that are hugely popular, hugely successful during his time there. And this has all been part of what I would call a progressive reframing of anti-corruption politics that thinks of neoliberalism itself as a form of corruption. I'm happy to talk a bit more about that later on. But yeah, there are concerns that different camps have raised. You know, some of these concerns are raised, as you would imagine, by sort of knee-jerk critics of AMLO, members of the opposition parties and allies and so forth. But there are also, I think, types of critiques that have a certain, I don't know, legitimacy in my personal opinion. Two that I would mention here are the way in which the military has been empowered over the past 6 years. Many of these infrastructure projects are actually managed, constructed, and designed by the military. And again, happy to talk about why that's the case. But it is the bottom line is that there has been a process of military empowerment in the past years, and there's also increasing environmental concerns, particularly in the project to revamp the state-owned oil company, and the obvious tension between fomenting the increase of fossil fuels under the objective of national energy sovereignty and the looming climate crisis.
And also, could you talk also in terms of the criticism, especially from other countries, of the judicial reform? What's your sense of that?
Right. So what was the judicial reform that just passed, first of all? It would put judges up for election. right? This includes up to the Supreme Court judges, right? Now, a couple of things to clarify here is judges, the Supreme Court judges in Mexico are already term limited, so it's not a lifetime appointment like it is in the U.S. So they would be limited to 8 to 15 years capped, right? And there's also a recent history of a revamping of the Supreme Court in the late 90s, right? So it doesn't hold the same sort of, let's say, sort of quasi-divine mystical character that it does in the U.S. It's been sort of, you know, meddled with much more recently. But what is the motivation for this push to have judges be elected? The motivation from the point of view of the government is judicial independence, actually, that there's a sort of politicization of the judiciary. It's too beholden to formal and semi-formal networks of influence of private interest groups, and putting judges up for election is a way of overcoming that. And a couple of important things about the context to keep in mind for this reform is that, as I was mentioning, the judiciary, the Supreme Court in particular, has become, at least according to the government, increasingly politicized, right? Even explicitly so, for example, there's a series of major legislative reforms during the six-year period that were overturned on, we could say, sort of petty proceduralist grounds, right? This included things like major reforms to the energy sector that would have given the state-owned electricity company a much stronger role, right? But there's also more concrete things, like, for example, at the beginning of the year, it was revealed that the head of the Supreme Court, Norma Piña, the head of the Supreme Court, had held secret meetings with the leader of the PRI and a very top, high-ranking leader of the PAN, so two of the parties of the neoliberal right. These were secret meetings held in a private address. The information was then leaked. Actually, the content of the meetings is still unknown, but the meetings themselves are quite troubling. Right? And in addition to that, there's an even longer standing dispute between the Supreme Court and the executive and the legislature, for that matter, over salaries, over compensation of the Supreme Court justices. So when AMLO took office, he voluntarily lowered his salary. And the Constitution, as it stands, states that no public official can make more than the president. So that meant that by default, the Supreme Court justices who have really high compensation packages would have to take a pay cut. They refused to do so against what the Constitution says. So they have been actually in violation of the Constitution for the past 6 years. And the list goes on and on. We could, last point I would say here, for example, by
we have 20 seconds.
Okay. The Supreme Court report on this, their own report, half of the people that work in the judiciary have family members in the judiciary, which just speaks to the level of nepotism and, again, formal networks and semi-formal networks of influence that exist there. So that's the context for the push.
We want to thank you for being with us. Edwin Ackerman is sociology professor at Syracuse University, author of Origins of the Mass Parties, Dispossession and the Party Form in Mexico and Bolivia. We'll link to your piece in Jacobin, AMLO's War on Neoliberal Corruption. We'll do an interview in Spanish at democracynow.org and post it at there. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The art of the mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.